This is Nachyomi, Sefer Shemuel Bet, chapter 11. This chapter is really the turning point in the entire story of David HaMelech. It's unfortunately a negative turning point, a turning point for the worse, as everything is downhill from here in the career of David HaMelech, pretty much. For the first time, we find David remaining behind in the palace while he sends Yoav, his general, and the army of Israel to lay siege to Rabat, which is the capital of Ammon. One evening, following an afternoon nap, David is strolling along the roof of the palace, and he observes a beautiful woman bathing. He investigates and finds out that her name is Bathsheba, and she's the wife of one of his finest officers, Uriah HaHiti, Uriah the Hittite. He sends for her, and they have an evening, a night together. She subsequently informs him that she has become pregnant as a result. Hoping to keep his indiscretion a secret, David summons Uriah from the battlefield, meets with him briefly, and hopes that he'll go home to be with his wife for the evening, and therefore cover up for David's mistake. But Uriah does not spend the night with Bathsheba. He sleeps with the other soldiers in their company in sort of a makeshift kind of a sleepover rather than go back to his house. David calls Uriah for another meeting the next day and asks him why he didn't go home the previous night. Uriah tells him that he thought it was totally inappropriate for him to be eating, drinking, having a good time, and sleeping with his wife, while his fellow soldiers and the Aron, apparently they brought the Ark, or a certain type of Ark, it's a discussion among the rabbis what exactly that's referring to, but the Ark of the Covenant is with the army of Israel as they fight against their enemies, and it would be inappropriate while the Aron and the Jewish people are encamped on the battlefield for him to go and sleep with his wife. David shares a meal with Uriah, gets him intoxicated, gets him drunk, but he again spends the night with the other soldiers and does not visit Bathsheba. His options apparently exhausted, David decides to compose a letter to Yoav and tells Yoav that in the next battle he should place Uriah in the front lines, pull back a little bit, and make sure that Uriah is killed in the course of fighting. Not knowing the contents of the letter, Uriah delivers his own death warrant to Yoav. Yoav carries out the instructions of David and sends back a message with a report on the progress of the siege. Sort of sandwiched in this report, towards the end of the report, is a mention in passing that when David asks questions about how the battle went, mistakes perhaps made, strategic mistakes made in the battle, that the messenger should add as an aside that Uriah HaHiti had died. The messenger does so, thereby not becoming aware also of the fact that the discussion of Uriah was something special between Yoav and David. It was something secretive, it was something planned, but the messenger's told to add it in an offhand way to David so that the messenger doesn't realize the significance of what's being conveyed. David is now informed of the latest developments, and he sends back word to Yoav, encouraging him not to focus too much on the death of Uriah, because after all, someone has to die in battle. Casualties are inevitable. After she finishes mourning the death of her husband, Bathsheba and David are married, so that the birth of their first child doesn't look suspicious. It goes without saying that this incident is met with much displeasure from Hashem's perspective, and that's how the chapter ends. Now, this story disturbs us on so many levels, and it's been the subject of discussion, and volumes of commentary have been written on it. There are a bunch of questions here that demand our attention, but we're just going to focus on one of the three key questions that present themselves. Most importantly, how do we explain the egregious moral lapses of David? We have come to know him as a religiously devout, consummately ethical human being. How did he rationalize this behavior? That's the biggest question on our minds. But the second question, which is more of a technical question, is how is David allowed to marry Bathsheba? The halakha is that when two people have an extramarital affair, they're not allowed to be married, even after the death of their spouses, even after divorce. They would once they have committed this transgression of adultery together, they can never be married to one another. So how does David marry her? And we know that the child produced from Bathsheba and David, one of their children, will be Shlomo HaMelech, who will be the next king of Israel. So how can this be justified halachically? The third question is, how is David placed on such a pedestal as the ideal Jewish king? He's going to be the ancestor of the Mashiach, and yet he committed such a terrible act. It seems like Shaul is looking very sympathetic right now, because as much as Shaul made his mistakes, he lost his kingdom for lesser offenses, for not killing Amalek, but that doesn't seem to hold a candle to the severity of the transgressions of David. So we're going to focus on those other two, the last two questions, really, in the next chapter. For now, we want to focus on how could David do this? Now, you may be familiar, many people are familiar with the Talmud's discussion of the story of David, and the classic statement that Kola Omer David Chata, Eno Ela To'eh, anybody who says that David actually committed the sin is making a mistake. That's one opinion in the Talmud. There is an opinion in the Talmud that takes the behavior literally as written and says that David committed these acts, and that's how the Abarbanel also understands the passages. But the second approach, with the most, is really the most famous one among traditionalists, that David did not violate anything legally prohibited here. Now, this view says that all Jewish soldiers who went out to war gave their wives gittin. They gave their wives bills of divorce. Why? Because if they were to go missing on the battlefield, they disappear or they die, but their body is never found. That would leave their wives chained as agunot. They would never be able to remarry. So to avoid that problem, they would give a get before they went out to war. This is still done today sometimes under certain circumstances. And this is what the Talmud says was done in the times of David. So therefore, Uriah wasn't really married to Bathsheba at the time, technically, that David took her, even though maybe ethically, morally, she had a commitment to Uriah, but legally not. So this school of thought also says that David was justified in killing Uriah because Uriah disrespected him and didn't listen to his orders to go to stay with his wife. He also called Yoav his master instead of David. So that implied placing Yoav above David, and that was disrespectful. And so therefore that gave David the legal right to have him executed. And this means that according to this interpretation, David didn't commit any technical violations over here. However, even these rabbis can't deny that David did a sin. David himself says in the next chapter that he sinned. The prophet tells him that he sinned. Hashem says that he sinned. Okay, and obviously the punishments that he receives show that he sinned. The only question is, what kind of sin was it? And the point that the rabbis are making, which I think is a valid point, whether you accept their interpretation of the text or not, is that the main message here is not a halachic message. We're not supposed to be looking at the Shulchan Aruch, looking at the code of Jewish law, to try to understand what violations David committed or didn't commit. That is not the point. The point here is to look at the moral quality of David's transgression. What does it say about his character? What was the error he made here as a human being? Not whether he could navigate around the technicalities of halacha to justify his behavior. So let's look at it from that standpoint. Up until this point, David has never used his power or influence for personal gratification or self-promotion. He's never manipulated or abused his position as king. In fact, this has been the quality of David that we most admire. Think about it. What amazes us and impresses us about David is how principled he is and how selfless he is. So it's so shocking to see him cast aside all of this, all of these values that have convinced us to love him so much. At a moment's notice, all of a sudden he becomes like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. We don't even recognize him. The text gives us a sense of how this failure of David came to be. In the opening sentences of the chapter, we are told that David sends his men out to battle without accompanying them. He stays back at the palace. He even enjoys the luxury of afternoon naps, and he's checking out girls from the top of the roof. So we also see that Uriah himself, in a way, is criticizing David for this because he says, how can I go home and eat and drink and sleep with my wife when my brothers and are out in battle on the battlefield? In other words, he's, in a way, there's a veiled criticism of David, that David is enjoying the luxury of being the king and seeing himself as above the menial task of defending and supporting his people, even as soldiers are dying every day. So this attitude was what led him to take another man's wife and then play games to cover up his misdeed, ultimately orchestrating Uriah's untimely death. So halachically justifiable, perhaps, and we have to assume that David rationalized it some way or another. But still, the text shows us David's true character, where he is failing here. He resisted amassing horses and wealth while he was still on the battlefield with his troops, as we saw in the previous chapter. However, after a while, partaking of the high life in the palace goes to his head, and he could not resist taking Bathsheba and then doing whatever was necessary to hide his indiscretion. It's also very interesting that it describes David as writing a sefer. He's writing a book to Yoav. We know that one of the mitzvot of a king that he has to do is write a sefer Torah. And yet we see David here writing warrant, the death warrant of Uriah to cover up his indiscretion. So we see that David has, in a way, reversed from being the ideal king of the Torah to being a king that leaves much to be desired. One interesting point for further consideration is, how much did Yoav and Uriah pick up in this whole drama? Did they know that something was going on? One gets the sense that Urya might have gathered that David was up to something because he keeps asking him to come to meetings that are unnecessary and he keeps inquiring about Urya's personal life. That might account for the sort of harsh tone in his second encounter with the king. Yoav must also have suspected something because he realized that there was a secret plan here of eliminating Urya while making it look like an accident or a casualty of war. We may never know exactly who knew or suspected what, but it's fascinating to try to read between the lines with these questions in mind.